possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. 20 years ago, Shenzhen, China was a town of 70,000 people. Today, it's home to 7 million. The city's population is made up of migrants who left farms looking for jobs in the city and a better life. They are part of the biggest migration in human history. And this migration, together with the sheer size of China's population, 1.5 billion, is fueling amazing growth in that country's economy. On the program today, we'll take a look at China today with an eye toward her future and what that future might hold for the U.S. and the world. Our guest is financial journalist Ted Fishman. He's the author of China, Inc., How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World. Fishman notes in his book's introduction that China's people are arguably the greatest natural resource on the planet. He says, quoting here, "How the Chinese and the rest of the world use that resource will shape our economy and every other economy in the world as powerfully as American industrialization and expansion have over the last 100 years. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Ted Fishman, has contributed articles to many publications. He has also been a commentator on the public radio program Marketplace. In the mid-1980s and early 90s, he was a member of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where he ran his own trading company. His book, China, Inc., was serialized in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. The publisher of the book is Scribner. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Ted Fishman, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, I'm so glad to be with you. Thank you.
A generation ago, China condemned capitalism. Now it embraces capitalism. What happened?
Well, for one thing, the old system bankrupted itself, and the country had no money in which to do many of the projects that communism set out to do, which were to provide its people with a bare minimum standard of living, health care, education, and food. And what was percolating in the countryside was were lots of mini-revolutions against the collectivization of China, in which farmers especially were gaming the system, buying officials, making arrangements with officials, and doing whatever they could to start their own small businesses out of the eye of the central government.
Mm.
And little by little, these projects took hold until they acquired a kind of mythic quality in China and offered an alternative to the communist plan at the time. And Deng Xiaoping saw these initiatives taking shape in the countryside and said, why don't we legitimize some of these on a small scale and see whether they take root? And they did take root. So much so that province by province, the market economy has spread, so that now it's all over China. And from 20 years ago, being in the situation which you described, in which the country was under the grip of state ownership of everything, now there are 85 million private businesses in China.
Hmm. Has China a plan for managing this huge migration? How is it doing to date, and what are China's leaders vision? What do they envision for the next decade?
There is no global plan for managing this great migration. And for a long time, the government tried to keep wraps on the migration and fought against it, making people have residency permits that kept them out of the cities, or at least kept them out of the kind of official apparatus that operates in the cities. And this has only changed recently, in which during which time the immigrants have acquired a kind of more official status, so much so that when the law changed in Shanghai, for example, the immigrant population went up from 0 to 4 million. And now the government acknowledges that, yes, indeed, there are 4 million immigrants from the countryside in Shanghai. And when you look around the city, what you see is not really a government plan to develop the city, but all sorts of diverse projects in which 97% of these 4 million people are employed, building new buildings. Shanghai's built 5,000 buildings over 15 stories in the last 6 years, and it's migrants who do all of that work and do similar work all over China, and are otherwise employed in this massive urbanization in which they themselves are, creating.
What's their quality of life?
Well, I think we can only assume that their quality of life is better than what they left. Otherwise, they wouldn't be so compelled to leave. But it begins fairly meager. Usually they come to a city in which they have friends. So their friends have told them what it is like to be in the city. And often they come, if they are young women, they come for factory jobs. And the life of a Chinese factory worker in one of these bottom-rung factory jobs is nothing we would wish on anyone we know. But in China, it's still seen as kind of a plum job. Mm. And Shenzhen, for example, the factories there overwhelmingly employ young women from all over China. And the description of their life sounds horrific. I would say it's even worse than the description we know of mill workers in New England in the 19th century. They live 12 to a room, rarely have any air conditioning. The food is provided on site. There are company stores. And the wages frequently are barely enough to stay ahead at all. Mm. But they do migrate out from those factory jobs into other opportunities in the economy. Sometimes they're great opportunities where they can work their way up the management ranks. And sometimes the opportunities are also things we won't wish on anybody. The sex industry in Shenzhen, for example, is very big.
And what's the situation in regard to the social support infrastructure? Is there any such thing? There's none.
There's none. Social support there on, from the government side is zero. But from family and friends, you get just about everything that you will get. And even though China is a migrant community and it's creating all of these melting pots, it's still relies very much on provincial loyalties and family loyalties, even in these far-flung adventures that people go on. Mm.
Financial journalist Ted Fishman is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of China, Inc., How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World. Listeners, you can join the discussion with your questions, comments, 333-9455. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Indiana on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello. Let me throw four or five things into a soup and ask you to talk about the interaction in the future. Number one, the main assumption is that things will go like it did with the Japanese, first paper toys, then all of a sudden, you know, superior optics and other industrial things. So is that as a backdrop Chinese population? United States military might and presumed technical superiority at the moment, European Union's using their money for expanding technological fronts, and throw in oil. Thanks a lot.
Wow. That's a stew. That's a big meaty stew. Ted, you want to comment?
Most globally, I would say about the question that about Japan and whether China will go the way of Japan is the caller is right, but there are also some other big issues that we should all think about when comparing China to Japan. Japan did climb up from a rubble and peonage following World War II, and to become a vast industrial and economic power. China will do the same. It started from a very low base, and it will climb quite high. But China is not like Japan. Japan focused on a few key industries, in which the technology in Japan got excellent in those industries, and that required a unified effort from China's industrial community, the government, and from its populace. But China's development, as you mentioned before, really doesn't follow a plan. It follows the dynamic of its own people. And although it is climbing the tech ladder and its goods are becoming increasingly sophisticated, it is not the subject of intense focus of the government. It is the intense focus of the industries that are there, often aided by multinational industries that come to China to take advantage of the brain power of the Chinese people. And I didn't really understand what the caller's question was about the economic union.
Yeah, well, I guess I could ask a question in regards to the economic union, or the European Union, excuse me.
Yeah, right.
T.R. Reid was a guest on the program a few weeks back, and he sees the EU as the next superpower. He thinks that the obstacle to China's ascendance is something that you also make note of in the book, and that is, you know, what you've been talking about here, the dynamism of its own people. And I have this passage actually marked of the questions that you pose very early in the book. You know, is China's government a wise warden or power mad and corrupt? Are its people happy with their progress or intolerably oppressed as citizens and abused as workers? And then a few pages later in the story, you write about the class system that exists in Shanghai. A man outside a club in the city protests his being denied entrance, and he's yelling, "This is China. Who are you to keep me out?" Lots of interesting issues here, all going back to the idea of the dynamism of China's people.
Yeah, those are all fascinating dynamics, and they are all part of what China is today. And if we were to look at those through the lens of an American, we often focus on the human rights question. And I am often asked when I talk around the country about this big, vast wealth divide that exists in China. And the Chinese themselves say now that the division between their new wealthy class and the farmer class is the widest in the world. And wealth there is increasingly concentrated in the hands of the economic elite, who not incidentally are the heirs to the political elite. And, this is of grave concern to us because we believe in a more egalitarian model for the world in which authoritarian regimes should not use their power to concentrate their economic might and in turn create political dynasties for themselves. But if you looked at it through a European lens, they are far more opportunistic. And the leaders of France and Germany are in China all the time. I believe Schroeder from Germany went to China 5 times last year. And none of China's political policies give the Europeans much pause at all. In fact, if they were to weigh the political tenor of China against the political tenor of the United States, often it seems recently that they prefer China because in many ways China, over the last 2 years, or at least since 9/11, can be seen as a status quo power, which is ironic when you think about it, because, as you pointed out, Celeste, in the beginning of your remarks, China was the most revolutionary communist party in the world at one time, the most vehemently anti-capitalistic. And it was seen as the big threat to the world, the most willing to upset the world's apple cart. But now, Europeans see America is most willing to upset the apple cart. We're the adventurers in the world. So they triangulate against us politically by going to China, increasing their ties with China, and using that as a counterbalance to the United States.
Mm. Where do you see the European Union fitting in between China and the U.S.? I mean, is the EU also a burgeoning superpower?
Well, economically, the EU needs China, but it also fears China. And China's role will have a huge impact on Europe's fortunes in the long run. European manufacturing is far more expensive than American manufacturing, and American manufacturing is far more expensive than Chinese manufacturing.
Hmm.
But on the other hand, the Europeans are much more, as it turns out, are much more aggressive investors in China than the United States. Volkswagen makes more Volkswagens in China than it does in Germany. The big European companies are using China as a way to get around Europe's own restrictive labor hiring practices. And China gives them a way to escape from paying high health care premiums, for example, or social insurance taxes. And in a way, China is used as a hammer for Europe's own working class. And you can see this in one labor agreement after another on the continent.
Hmm. Well, China is also a hammering device on labor in the U.S.
Yeah, well said. True.
True. One of the stories you opened the book with is set in Milwaukee at a Harley-Davidson plant about 2 years ago. And some Bush administration officials were visiting. And the plant's workers had an understanding of China that had escaped the secretaries of labor and treasury. You want to tell us that story?
Yeah, this was a mere, 19 months ago now, when there was a bus tour from the top economic officials in the Bush cabinet at the time. It was the Secretary of Labor, Secretary of Commerce, and the Secretary of the Treasury. And this was just a couple months after the first Bush tax proposal returned money. You know, we all got a check from the Treasury, which was money, pocket money to spend to revive the economy. And they were going to travel by bus to sympathetic audiences around the country and trumpet the triumph of the tax plan and the administration's pro-business stance. Well, their first stop was this plant in Milwaukee, which was the Harley-Davidson plant. And the iconography for the officials was irresistible because here was a plant of rugged individualists, flag wavers. They made America's last great big motorcycle, and it would be a great backdrop for this pro-business bus tour, or so they thought. But when they got there, they encountered question after question about China. What are you doing about Chinese manufacturing, about the low cost of Chinese manufacturing, about all the benefits Chinese manufacturers get from their government that we can't match? And in Wisconsin, like Illinois and Indiana, where many plants face severe competition, not just from Chinese manufacturers, but from large American companies who are no longer using the second and third tier American manufacturers that were the mainstays of their supply chain. The companies gathered in the Harley-Davidson conference room, auditorium, were very upset. So it wasn't just workers asking these tough questions, but owners of other businesses, other industrial businesses, and managers of other industrial businesses. And the cabinet secretaries had no idea what hit them. They didn't expect this line of questioning on China at all.
Mm. One of the biggest retail forces in the United States, if not the biggest now, is Walmart. You note in the book, its growth is inseparable from China's rise in economic power. Can I talk about that?
Yeah, well, China is Walmart. There's only one thing big. Sometimes I think there's only one thing you could talk about that's
bigger than China.
It's Walmart, right? But of course, China's much bigger. But Walmart seems to be indispensable to China's rise, and China is, of course, indispensable to Walmart's rise. Walmart did $256 billion worth of business in the United States last year, which I think is about what would that be? That would be about a quarter percentage of our gross domestic product. But the imports from China that are eventually funneled through Walmart stores account for 1% of Walmart's gross domestic product. Walmart You know, one out of every $100 in the Chinese economy is tied to Walmart. 70% of the goods sold in a Walmart store have a Chinese component in them. And what Walmart's genius is that it has found a way to be a direct conduit of the Chinese manufacturing Goliath directly into the homes of Americans. And the benefit in low-cost goods to consumers is phenomenal. Walmart's not alone in this. If you look at what cheap manufacturing out of China has done for American consumers, it's a far bigger benefit than that Bush tax cut, for example. I had an economist do the calculation for me. It's Gary Huffbauer. He's at the Institute for International Economics. And according to his calculation, China saves the average American consumer about $550 a year, not just because it makes things inexpensively, but because manufacturers around the world that have to compete with Chinese manufacturers also lower their prices. Well, the Bush tax cut only delivered $1,100 for a family of four, or half as much as the Chinese savings to American families. And Walmart is the leader in that.
On the other hand, Walmart is pushing its suppliers to build in China.
Yeah. I mean, we all wear two hats when it comes to China. We wear the hat as the consumer who benefits, and we wear the hat of the person who's trying to keep our own standard of living up by making a higher wage. And because of Walmart's modus operandi, which demands that its suppliers keep their prices stable or more frequently lower their prices from year to year for the goods that they sell into Walmart, there is this inexorable pressure to move production abroad.
Hmm. Does Walmart yet have a store or stores in China?
Oh, they sure do. And you walk in with great curiosity wondering how will they be different, and then are a little disappointed to see how much they're the same. And you're not the only one with that disappointment, because when Chinese shoppers enter a Walmart store, they're expecting to see all kinds of fabulous American goods that they've never seen before, and all they see are things that are made in China. And the company now has plans to open 100 more stores in China.
Oh, so China, I mean, Walmart is, now I'm confused, China and Walmart. Walmart is positioning itself here then in a number of ways.
That's right.
Yeah.
There's no part of the Chinese equation in which Walmart is absent, really.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Eureka on line 4. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. I believe I've heard your guest on another radio program, and I believe you said this statistic. I just want to verify it and wonder if you could have any other comparisons for the major discount stores, that Walmart produces 80% of the products sold at Walmart. Is that accurate?
Well, I think what I've been saying is that 70% of the products sold in Walmart have a Chinese component, right?
I see. And would you have any figures available for the other major discount stores, such as Target or Kohl's or Kmart?
No, I don't. The reason is that the mix depends for now very much on how much those other retailers make their money selling clothing. So
mm-hmm.
far, China is not a big player in the in any clothing besides leather clothing, because of the quotas on textiles and apparel. But that will change, and those numbers will go up, because China eventually will be the dominant textile and garment manufacturer in the world, too.
May I ask two other very short questions,
sure.
please? I believe in the promo it was mentioned there was a town that had grown from something like 70,000 to 7 million.
Yes.
Was that
Shenzhen? It's near Hong Kong.
Near Hong Kong. Is that town mainly doing Walmart productions?
I don't know that they're mainly doing Walmart, but it is designed almost entirely around manufacturing for export.
And this is what I have gotten from like a documentary, Heart of the Dragon, by I believe McNeil Lair did about 15 years ago. But would it be true today that, and I don't know if you said it or someone said, that the vast majority of the population, somewhere, say, greater than 800 million, still is in the countryside, mainly peasants? Would that be accurate for a kind of very oversimplified population distribution of China?
That's right, and that's what's going to tilt. China, compared to even other developing countries, has a much lower rate of urbanization so far.
I see. So,
and by the time it finishes this urbanization, it may be higher. So that's where you're getting this vast wave that's less described as the largest migration in human history.
So it's about 1.3 billion total, and of that, about 500 urban, 800 million rural. Would that be somewhat accurate?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Actually, thank you.
Thanks for the call.
One interesting thing about China's population is the miscounting. The official population of China is 1.3 billion, which now makes it the largest country in the world. But Western intelligence agencies, who kind of calculate population using other means, including food consumption, and then they extrapolate back to the number, think that number might be under counted by 200 to 300 million people, which would make the rounding error on the Chinese population equal to the entire size of our population.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Ted Fishman is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of China, Inc., How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Going back to one of the things that you were talking with our listener in Eureka about, the clothing issue, textiles, when is that trade restriction going to fall?
It's supposed to change in the next year, I believe, and there's already some political jihad to protect American textile manufacturers and garment manufacturers, but it's a much bigger deal for other countries. Most of those jobs have already disappeared from the United States, but in places like Bangladesh, which now export a lot of clothes to us, China coming online as a major garment manufacturer, unrestricted by quotas, could put 2 million people out of work in Bangladesh. This has enormous political consequences for us because these quotas were one of the chief means of political largesse that we had to spread around the world and to promote our agenda for the world. As the quotas come down, we won't have this gift to give to other countries.
Hmm. This is hard to sort of put your mind around, the idea that not only are we being affected, but a country like Bangladesh, other countries in the world. Maybe you could offer us some kind of perspective on what this will mean for Bangladesh.
Well, I'm afraid I'm not that sanguine for the prospects of poorer countries that have to compete with China. And one of the reasons is that China is very successful at attracting capital from the rest of the world. China now gets more money in foreign investment than any other country in the world, including the United States, which has traditionally been far and away the leader. This year, China will get about $70 billion in foreign investment. Bangladesh would be lucky to get 1% of that. And especially without any protection for its textile industry, there will be very little incentive for foreign capital to come in and to help develop Bangladesh's economy. The only hope is if the Bengalis can figure out a way to make their
case in Washington.
Well, not to make their case in Washington. I don't think they have much hope there, but to make their industries more efficient. And they're probably already about as efficient as they can be. You know, one effect that the Chinese economy has that I think is most troubling, Celeste, is that it deindustrializes much of the rest of the world because low-cost manufacturing almost inevitably migrates there. The tiger economies of Southeast Asia, which were doing so spectacularly well building up their domestic industries, now are reverting to resource-based economies because China will pay top dollar for their resources and then beat them on price and manufacturing. And so you have them prospering in the short run, but because they're deindustrializing, their development turns back the clock on progress 20 years.
Hmm.
It's very sobering.
Yeah. The growing reluctance on the part of foreigners to finance the debt of the United States, will that result in more capital going to China?
I don't know. It seems like the more capital goes to China, the higher the willingness is for foreigners to finance our debt. The dynamic works this way. Industry is built up in China to be crackerjack and world-class with foreign money. China earns a lot of foreign currency from those industries. It needs a place to park those currencies. And the place it so far has liked to park it is in U.S. Treasury bonds. So the better China does, the higher the willingness of the world to buy our bonds.
Hmm. In the book, you note that China's economy is expanding at an official rate of 9.5%. A couple of questions here. How does that compare with the rate of growth in the U.S. and in the EU? And the big question I think I have is, you know, is that rate of growth, 9.5%, sustainable?
Well, nobody has thought it was sustainable for the last 20 years, and yet every year it seems to come out around that level. So I can only say, well, going with the preponderance of opinion on the issue, no, of course it's not sustainable, with the caveat being that it probably will be. So, you know, that might be just one of those things that's beyond human comprehension. But even if it halves or even if it goes down by two-thirds, it would still be running at a level that we in the United States would think is quite good. Our economy, in a really terrific year, grows at 3 or 4 or 5%. Mm-hmm. And that's when we're all real happy and running out to buy more expensive cars and more expensive houses. Our economy, compared to other developed economies, has been the strongest. Europe is, for now, especially Western Europe, has been in stagnant, and that is one reason that makes them more hungry for Chinese solutions to their problem. You can even see that in this recent news about the arms embargo, you know, that President Bush was trying to get the Europeans to stick to last week. You know, Europe really needs a place to sell its arms because they're big-ticket items and can spur their economy. And the continent just now, it does not have a big enough appetite for that industry to sustain it on its own. And so they are turning to China to not only provide new dollars into their economy, but to sustain an industry that Europe itself could not keep afloat.
Mm. I wonder what the attitude about that is in China, because if you look at the EU, that's one of the reasons they've been as successful as they've been, is that they have not spent a lot of money for defense.
Right, right. Well, that's you know, all of these things work together. You know, as China becomes increasingly powerful, and the United States may have to focus more on its Pacific defense. We may be focusing less on our efforts to keep Europe stable. You know, we have a lot of troops in Europe that we may withdraw. And China may be the one factor that forces Europe to spend more on its defense indirectly.
Mm. And it would force us then also to just to reposition ourselves.
Exactly,
and our level of defense spending would remain high.
That's right. Right.
Costing us, since, you know, you could make that argument.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Of course you could.
Yeah.
And China is very anxious to have a much more sophisticated, technologically advanced defense force than it has right now, and one that can look out at the rest of the world. Right now, China's defense force exists almost entirely as per internal security.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting when you were talking about Europe's preference for China. I read that Chirac says that he expects the future to have a multipolar world, with one of the poles being China, and that we have to accept that. And the way we deal with it is to promote multilateralism, which he defined as a way of organizing the world such that there's the necessary authority to avoid the conflicts between major poles. And that means rejecting unilateralism, and that's what we're doing. We're embracing unilateralism. So, and that kind of thinking, I think, also says a lot about the way they handle multiculturalism. But actually, you might want to comment on that. But I was kind of curious about something else. I read about from last August. There was an International Congress of Psychology in Beijing, and apparently you spent a lot of time there, so I thought I'd ask you if there's a professor, Wang Deng Thing, I don't know how to pronounce it, but I'm assuming that's it, and he presented a paper at the International Congress of Psychology, and he said that he's been looking into the differences between Western psychology and Asian psychology, and in particular in personality. And he uses seven dimensions, and he gets totally different results than Western psychologists do. So, and that he thinks that Chinese psychology has a lot more to do with family ties and social relations. And I was curious if you spent a lot of time there, if you've ever come to the conclusion that the Chinese psychology truly is different than the Western psychology. And I guess I'll hang up and listen. I got to go say things.
Okay. Well, Celeste, what should I tackle first there?
Why don't you tackle the second part first, I think.
All right. Are Chinese hardwired to think differently than Americans?
Or maybe not hardwired, but that's just the way the society is set up.
Yeah. Well, there are certain differences, and some of these are just some of these are cultural. You know, Asians have what could generally be defined as an Asian set of values, but they're not all that foreign to American families either. It might just be a matter of emphasis, where the fortunes of children are very tied to their parents, and they see their actions as reflecting on their parents, and their parents' actions reflecting on them, and this informs how they go about planning their futures, and how much they study, for example, would be the best example I could think. You know, when if you study well, you honor your parents and your ancestors. We don't have that view in America. If you study well here and do well here, your parents will be proud. Your ancestors probably don't care much, but your bosses might care a lot.
Well, another factor here, this makes me think about how this huge migration from rural to urban, whole families might not go, but several children will go.
Yeah, I mean, there's this middle generation that goes, where the older people stay behind and the young children stay behind, but the most capable workers take off, and often that means that the smartest, most physically fit people leave these villages, leaving it to be the villages end up being the lands of the old and the very young, and making the countryside that much less desirable.
And another factor here, something that we talked about earlier, is that the social infrastructure in these burgeoning cities is non-existent, so you have to rely on one another, your brothers, your sisters, your neighbors, the people who've come from where you've come from, maybe, that you might find in the city.
Right, right. And in some ways, this mirrors the pattern of migration in the United States, where you had certain ethnic groups concentrated in certain industries. You know, where stonemasons, for example, where I live in Chicago, have traditionally been Italian. You know, but as time goes on, you know, it fills in with all kinds of people.
Yeah. And the listener also commented on, and now I should have made a note. Maybe you recall, Ted.
About the EU,
yeah,
and the triangulation.
Yes,
you know, I think this is such a fascinating topic and such a very important topic for Americans. You know, our unilateralism has yet to play itself out. You know, we may come to good, we may come to grief, but in my own opinion is that it's that there is some danger in triumphalism. Mm. But the multilateral alternative is no bargain whatsoever. The Europeans play a very dangerous game by balancing China against the United States. Power politics are extraordinarily perilous. And China is, in the long run, no more willing a multilateral power than any other power that existed in the history of the world. And they have no natural affinity towards the Europeans yet, and except in the same way that the Europeans will use China against us. And I think you put your finger on it earlier, Celeste. You say, you know, this will just mean everybody wants more of the most dangerous tools they can get, because we'll all be balancing off against each other. And I have to ask myself, and we should all ask ourselves, are the Europeans' interests really that divergent from the United States that they ought to become the best friends of the last communist, large communist authoritarian country in the world? And I don't think so.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Champaign on line two. Good afternoon.
Hi. I'm just puzzled about one thing. I can understand how the Chinese might be able to beat out, say, the South Koreans, because the Chinese labor would now be much cheaper than the South Korean labor. But I don't understand how the Chinese can so certainly outdo the Bangladeshis.
Well, it's there's two factors involved. One is that investment tends to go where companies feel that they exist in a stable environment. Bangladesh is not perceived to be as stable as China, and it's quite vulnerable to natural disaster in addition. So one way that the Chinese beat out the Bangladeshis is by marrying the tide of foreign capital with the low labor force, and it, because it is the preferred place of doing business. The other reason is that because China, manufacturing in China exists in a backdrop of a country that is better organized for industry than Bangladesh, so that shipping is easier, transportation of all sorts is easier, computer skills are higher. The things that you need to service your manufacturing generally get done better, swifter, and at lower cost. So even if somebody sewing in Bangladesh makes less than a Chinese worker, the ecology of the Chinese economy makes your manufacturing overall lower price.
Does that apply also to India, do you think?
India and China, that remains to be seen. I think India can be a real formidable competitor with China in virtually anything that it sets about doing. But it's not there yet. Its real development is only, its accelerated development is only about 2 or 3 years, whereas China has been going for 20.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon, the questions. Before we wrap up here, we've got to wrap up now. I wanted to ask you about the potential of China for the U.S. in terms of is China being a market for us?
Oh, the potential is phenomenal. And, you know, one thing I try and do in the book is tell the story of how things can go wrong and also how things can go right, because mm-hmm. there's perils and opportunities. And, you know, we all have to understand those for ourselves, but we also have to understand them for us as a country. China is going to have 100 million middle-class consumers very soon, and they may very well like the things Americans make as much as the rest of the world does. The big challenge for us is how to find a way so that our high-value goods can be sold in China. We exist in a knowledge economy, and knowledge economy is very easily pirated, so that movies, software, trademarks, virtually everything high value in the United States economy is copied in China, where it's purchased everywhere else in the world. Unless we find a way to get the Chinese to purchase it rather than counterfeit it, we may not have anything to sell them.
Yeah, and not only is it that intellectual property of the of, let's say, films and that kind of thing, but also it comes back down to manufacturing, and you write about, you know, the impact China has had on the auto industry in the United States.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
what happens in the auto industry is astonishing, because whole cars can be copied, whole production lines can be copied, and China wants to be one of the world's great car producers. And one way it's getting there is by getting technology on the cheap, which is to say, to pirate it.
Yeah. Makes China a tough partner.
Oh, yeah. China's a tough partner. Oh. You have to rethink the way you do business, and it ought to make Americans rethink the way that we deal with China, because we are their biggest customer, and unless we use this power as their customer to get them to find a way so that we get paid for our high-value goods, this relationship will be too one-sided. Mm.
Ted, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Ted Fishman has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a financial journalist. He is the author of China, Inc., How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World. The book is published by Scribner. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Tom Rogers.
Thanks, Celeste. Good afternoon, everybody. Sitting in for Todd Gleason for the moment. He'll be here for the closing market report coming up at 2:06 Central Time. Sell-off today on the Board of Trade. We saw all of the contracts that we're watching down for the day except for oats. We'll go to the March wheat first of all, where the high reached 335 today, the low trading price 329. The settlement was at 330 at the end of the day. That was down 7.25 cents from Monday's settlement. May had a high of 343.5, the low 337, settled at 338.25, down 7. July wheat, the high 349.5, the low 343, settled at 344.5, down 7. September wheat had a high of 354, a low of 349. The settled just over the low at 349.5, down 7.25. And the December wheat contract, the high 363, the low of 356, and the settlement at 356.5, down 6.75. Corn ended lower. The March had a high of 213, the low 210.75. The settlement just above that at 211, down 3.5. May had a high of 221.75, the low 219, the settlement at 219.25, down 3.5. July corn at a high of 229, a low of 226, the settlement 226.75, down 3. September corn, our high today 234.5, the low price 232, settlement at 232.25, down 3. December corn at a high of 241.75, the low 239.25, settled at 240, that's down 2. And March of 05 corn, or 06 corn, had a high of 247.5, the low 245.25, settled at 246, down 1.75. The oats had an update today. The high price for March oats was 174, the low 162, settled at 172.5. That was up 11 cents on the day. May had a high of 157, a low of 152.5, the settlement 156.5, up 3.75. March soybeans today had a high of 618, the low 604.5, the settlement just above that at 605, down 10.5 cents on the day. May had a high of 626, the low 612.5, settlement at 613.25, down 8.75. July beans, the high 629.5, the low 617, settlement at 617.5, down 7.5. August had a high of 628, the low 617, it settled at 617.5, down 7.25. September soybeans had a high of 619 today, the low 612. That's where it settled, 612, down 6. And November farside beans had a high of 622, a low of 612 a bushel. The settlement at 614.25, down 4.75. Over to the products now. March soybean meal at a high today of 184.80, the low 181.30, settled at 181.60, down 1.40. May contract at a high of 186.50, the low 183, settled at 183.30, down 80. In bean oil for March, the high 23.07, the low 22.60, settled at 22.70, down 52. And May bean oil had a high of 23.28 and a low of 22.70, the settlement 22.91. That's down 44 cents. We'll have more on the trade on the Board of Trade coming up in the closing market report at 2:06 Central Time. And now, for what happened today on the commodity, or in the mercantile exchange, rather, here's Celeste.
Okay, Tom, it was a higher day today for livestock prices. March feeder cattle, the high today $100.12.5, the low $99.40, the settlement $99.97.5, that up 82.5. April $99.05, the high $98.10, the low $98.87.5, the settlement, that up 95. May 98.15, the high 97.25, the low, the settlement 97.97 and a half, that up 72 and a half. April live cattle 86.90, the high 86.20, the low 86.50, the settlement, the change there up 45. June live cattle, the high today 82.90, the low 82.25, the settlement 82.62 and a half, that up 27 and a half. April lean hog 75.70, the high 74.50, the low 75.25, the settlement, that up 102 and a half. May 77.50, the high 76.45, the low 77.20, the settlement, that up 72 and a half. June 80.80, the high 79.40, the low 80.55, the settlement, that up 125. And July lean hog 77.20, the high, the low 75.75, finishing at 77.10, that up 147 and a half. March bellies, today's high 90.05, the low 88.50, the settlement 90.02 and a half, that finishing up 192 and a half. Let's see if I can refresh my screen here this afternoon and tell you what's happening on Wall Street. The Dow is currently up 52 points at 10,818. The NASDAQ up 14 points at 2066. The S&P 500 up 6 at 1209.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Bill Roscoe from Falls Church, Virginia writes, "Dear Dr. Science, at many Washington, D.C. airports and stadiums, I see signs for satellite parking. Why don't I see any satellites?"
You can't see the satellites because they're covered with cars. This is a common problem. Our thrifty Pentagon, in its constant quest to save taxpayers' money, uses these satellites as parking ramps until they're ready to be shot into space. Unfortunately, many of these satellites still have cars on them when launch day comes around. Then it becomes a job for the National Security Council to locate the owners of these cars or have the cars towed. Lately, of course, with Iran and Nicaragua, the NSC has been shirking its duty. This has in turn led to a slowdown in the space program and in Star Wars. So I suggest you pay your parking tickets promptly. You're not only helping to reduce the deficit, you're assuring that satellites won't be shot into space with parked cars all over them.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. For more information, visit us on the web at drscience.com.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: First National Bank and Trust Company, Clinton; GCOM Incorporated, Savoy; and Areawide Technologies in Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Guess they had to go. I think it's .com. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. The broadcast.